are taking the challenge of climate change, the challenge of equity, the challenge of a different way of doing progress to the political sphere, and its time has come.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, the programme that tracks our transition to a safe climate. This week we continue our look at the political party's climate policies by zeroing in on the Greens. One might ask, if the Green Party have the policies to deal with the climate crisis and the other party's policies fall short or even head in the wrong direction, then why are they not a more prominent feature on the UK's political landscape? And indeed, the desire of the party not to be left out in the political wilderness at this critical time is the principal rationale behind their decision to elect their first leader at their conference in London earlier this month, in the person of Caroline Lucas. As a party who believe in decentralisation and distributed power, this policy has proved somewhat contentious within the party membership. This is how Caroline Lucas dealt with the issue in her acceptance speech.
I stand here today as the first leader that this party has ever elected, a momentous responsibility, a symbol of how we're prepared to change not our principles, but how we put our principles into action. And I never imagined that when I had my sons 12 and 15 years ago, that I'd have to fight so hard for their basic right to live in a clean, safe world. But if we believe our fight is for everyone's right to live a decent life, for the dignity of people all over the world, for the survival of the planet, then we must not, cannot, settle for the satisfaction of just being right, of being able to say, we told you so, when it all goes wrong. We are not entitled to stay on the political margins. We should look for power, win it, and use it. I stand here today as the first leader that this party has ever elected, a momentous responsibility, a symbol of how we're prepared to change not our principles, but how we put our principles into action. But think of the responsibility that has fallen to us. The one party to tell the people of this country the truth about the future we face and the changes we need to make. But to meet that responsibility, we also have to stay just as we are. If I thought that the role of leader was power at all costs, a new Labour pact of selling the party's soul, I would never have stood as leader, and you would never have elected me. The Green Party has always had its leaders, thousands of them, and that is how it must stay. And so, until we meet again, lead on.
In that spirit of every member is a leader, I spoke to Jonathan Essex, a Green Party member from Surrey who has just stepped down as campaigns coordinator, about the party's climate policies.
So I guess my starting point is that none of the other parties really come up to scratch. None of the other parties really have policies in place that are going to help the UK be a leading player in solving the climate crisis. The Tories, that the analysis by the Green Standard is that they're basically more rhetoric than substance at the moment. Labour seem intent on passing an ineffectual climate change bill, weakening EU measures to tackle climate change, and have lots of policies that will lock us into a high carbon future. I mean, I've just been down to the Lib Dems conference, and they seem to have a relatively good package of policies, but not good enough compared to what we need to do in terms of the latest science. But this has been the kind of heart of what the Greens have been about, in a sense. Environmental protection is written into your core beliefs. So I'm hoping that you've got the policies that match up to it, really.
Certainly, one thing the Green Party does is set out to be a party that's sustainable enough. The other parties talk about how we can be slightly greener, how we can be fairer. But ultimately, we need a sustainable society. We need a society where we have quality of life for all within environmental limits, not slightly better quality of life and exceeding climate limits. We actually need to deal with the problem. So what the Green Party does is bring together a set of policies that stake out where we need to be and then describe how we're going to get there, not simply going along the same business as usual, but in a slightly greener or a slightly fairer way.
Right. I mean, if you don't have an environment to support you, then things like the economy aren't going to happen, are they? I mean, I remember Rowan Williams saying that economy is a subset of the environment and not the other way around.
Certainly,
something along those lines, anyway.
Certainly, I would say the idea of green economics, as opposed to economics where only money matters, so money is simply the tools to get us where we need to go, not the goal in itself. So rather than chasing a goal of economic growth where we consume more and more stuff, what we need to do is maximise quality of life, maximise well-being, focus on happiness as a goal. So a different way of thinking about economics is central to green politics. So we're not really an environmental party. We're a party which has a different approach to economics, a different approach to politics, because we want to actually head in a different direction.
I've scanned your climate change policies. There's a whole chapter up online there. And from an international perspective, I notice you're critical of the Kyoto framework. The targets are too low. Not everybody is on board. The US is not on board, and developing countries are not part of a deal yet. And the flexible mechanisms are basically just a way of kind of creative accounting and people making lots of money rather than actually cutting emissions. What kind of deal do you think we need at an international level that can really be effective?
The current approach simply doesn't work. The current approach is to have a load of politicians meet up and debate the self-interest of their different countries and come up with something which is always going to be a compromise. So it's never as good as what any country will do on its own, and it's never going to match up to the science. And then it's backed up by a set of economic mechanisms which were developed by stock traders and policymakers in America, have led us to mechanisms like the emissions trading scheme in Europe, which frankly do not deal with climate change. And what they do is limit the amount of action which we have in other areas. What we need to have is an agreement which is both sufficient but isn't also a stumbling block to real action at a local level and real action at a national level. We need to have policies that leverage more action, not market mechanisms which allow business as usual to progress and almost imagine that somehow we're going to make the big cuts later. The current approach is not working. The Kyoto Protocol was not adopted by many countries, and even those that did adopt it, many, like Canada, just completely missed the targets. It didn't have any enforcement mechanism whatsoever, and it didn't really filter down to the local level. If you go back to the Rio summit in 1992, that had an implementation plan which included local Agenda 21 groups, the intention being that it was a bottom-up approach that was needed to match the top-down agreements. We have empty, vacuous, top-down agreements backed up by economic mechanisms that simply will not deliver a future that is sustainable.
Okay, so you're actually backing the contraction and convergence model so that everybody ends up with an equal right to emit, whether they're a rich country or a poor country, on a per capita basis?
Yes, we support contraction and convergence as a framework, and as a framework within which business, government, communities, individuals, organisations can all reduce their emissions sufficiently and fairly. Contraction convergence isn't like the emissions trading scheme. It isn't just an economic measure. It's a framework to allow individual countries to choose how they will meet their targets. So, for example, within the UK, the Green Party supports tradable energy quotas as a way of individuals reducing their emissions, but having the maximum amount of freedom to choose how we spend the emission limits, the carbon quotas, which we each have.
And you think that's a fairer option than green taxes, and perhaps you consider it to have other advantages as well?
Well, certainly. I mean, green taxes, as fronted by the mainstream parties, won't take us all the way we need to go. We do actually need limits, not taxes. Green taxes on their own won't actually give us a fairer system, because many of our taxation measures are aggressive. For example, in the UK, we have taxes on transport, but the highest taxes are for local transport, and aviation, the fastest growing form of transport and a massive impact on climate change, isn't really taxed at all. The same thing applies to energy bills. Currently, it's most expensive per unit to have a small amount of energy use in the home, but those who use lots of energy can buy that extra energy more cheaply. The Greens in Europe are proposing a renewable energy directive which reverses that trend and promotes progressive energy taxation. One other important thing is the green solution to climate change isn't an environmental one. It's an environmental and social one. We need to build sustainable communities within environmental limits. It isn't sufficient just to put a cap on our emissions and trade that. We need to cap and share. That's what contraction and convergence is. It puts a ceiling on our emissions, allows us to share what we do together. So by working together, by having public transport rather than private transport, by developing communities where many people would choose to do different things, we actually develop diverse and sustainable societies where our security is based on what we do for each other rather than on securing oil and gas and fossil fuels from foreign states, like, for example, the US is promoting in its wars on terror, its wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So currently you've got a 90% target by 2030 compared to a 1990 baseline. So in just over 20 years' time, we'll have a carbon budget in the UK of about 10% of what we had in 1990. That's a very radical carbon budget and a very radical timetable, but that's pretty much what the science is asking for, isn't it? I think that is pretty close to what people from the Tyndall Centre, for example, are saying.
That's right. What the Green Party calls for is for a 90% cut in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, and that's consistent with the science and the Tyndall Centre. It's consistent with the sort of targets and the sort of ambitions of the Transition Town movement. And it's also consistent with Zero Carbon Britain, a report by the Centre for Alternative Technology in Wales, which sets out how we might actually get there. It paints an interesting picture of where we should be going and what it's actually going to look like and how life is going to be better and more secure in 2030 if we take this approach.
So it's a 9% drop per year, pretty much, on that trajectory in terms of carbon emissions in the UK. To achieve that, we can't rely just on technology, can we? We need some kind of demand management measure, which none of the other political parties seem to be really facing up to. The Labour Party, for example, has dismissed tradable energy quotas as an idea whose time has not yet come. But, I mean, that's pretty much the only way that's going to bring us a change in behaviour, which can bring about reductions fast enough to enable us to live within our carbon budget.
Yes, I think it is important to combine low and ultimately zero carbon technologies with lifestyle changes. There's no point building zero carbon homes. And then our average TV purchase in the UK is 42-inch TVs, 240-watt TV. So we go around changing light bulbs to low energy, and then we buy massive TVs and more computers. We need to match the behaviour change with the technology, and that's been recognised by other groups too. The Local Government Association has said that time for pilot projects now has to be over, and we need to not have technology campaigns on behaviour change and changes in local government structures all separate, but we need to actually bring these together. One example of where that's happening is in Kirklees, where Andrew Cooper, one of the Green councillors there, has worked with the Conservative administration to have a Green Party initiative which was taken on board, which is for a house-by-house, street-by-street free insulation programme, which is now being rolled out across the borough. That's an amazing idea, but it'll only work and only achieve real emission reductions if those technologies which are installed in the houses will be matched by behaviour changes and good, positive lifestyle choices on the inside as well.
Two kind of critical demands that are coming from campaigners at the moment. One is that there should be no new coal without carbon capture and storage, and the other one being that there should be a moratorium on biofuels. I'm presuming that you're supporting both of those measures.
Both of those are totally backed by the Green Party. Firstly, on coal. Coal has caused half of the carbon in the atmosphere already, and to take a situation of building new coal-fired power stations in the UK without that technology to make sure that none of the carbon ends up in the atmosphere would be ludicrous. It would be a backward step. What we need to do, if we're to do carbon capture and storage, is to make sure that it's 100% of the carbon is being captured and stored, and it's from the first date. And we need to have a renewable energy-led electricity generation, not just building more of the same, more big, old fossil fuel power stations. It's time for change. It's time for green energy that both generates differently, provides jobs, and allows us to create sustainable communities, not keep going down the same path. And then in terms of the biofuels, like Richard Branson is proposing it to put into his planes, which is a ludicrous idea, biofuels are climate change accelerators. This is large-scale agrofuel production of biofuels coming from jatropha in Africa or palm oil in Indonesia. Not your local chip fat, that's fine. But your big biofuel imports into a car will turn the emissions of a Mini into the emissions of an estate car. It will turn the emissions of a state car into a 4x4 or a Porsche. What it does is make a normal vehicle into a climate monster. It's a ridiculous idea, and even a small percentage like we currently have, 2.5%, is making a significant increase to the climate impact of our transport in the UK now. So we need to have a moratorium on biofuels.
A couple of weeks ago on this programme, we ran a talk by Dr. Pachauri, the head of the IPCC, who was picking up on the point that livestock farming and consumption, so meat and dairy essentially, was responsible for 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions. What kind of policies does the Green Party have for dealing with that? I don't think any of the other major parties have really started to address this seriously yet.
Well, certainly our current food production systems aren't sustainable. We use a ridiculous amount of packaging in our food, so the amount of plastic you get when you buy many things at supermarkets has a greater impact on the environment than the food itself. And then our industrial agricultural system isn't the sort of thing that's actually going to allow us to generate all the energy we need and grow all the food we need within the UK and be sustainable. What we should have is local organic agricultural systems. We can take on board some of the urban agricultural successes from overseas. And London, for example, could grow a lot of its own vegetables, just like has been shown in the Transition Towns move as a good model to adopt. And yes, meat production is quite heavy in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, and we should be looking to massively reduce our food impact on the climate. And one way to do that is to reduce our meat consumption.
I'm looking at some of your agricultural policies, and you would phase out a lot of the subsidies which encourage intensive farming, chemical inputs and overproduction, and essentially, I guess, keep meat cheaper than it would be. And there's also a switch of support from large producers to smallholders, and that's a general theme among green policies in terms of businesses and such like.
Yes, certainly we would encourage, and we do support, a shift from a government that's tied to big business in the way it funds everything, including agriculture. But also, looking across the board, we currently have a system where supermarkets are being built out of town day in, day out. We have a regeneration program of our cities, quite often driven by commercial interests. What instead we should do is promote and support local business, local smallholders on the agricultural side, local shops, and businesses that generate local sustainable solutions. So, for example, we should do more reuse rather than throwing things away. And so we certainly don't support the current trend to privatise our waste disposal into a series of incinerators across the country, which is an absolute travesty. It just is accelerating climate change again by an inappropriate measure applied for the benefits of business rather than the benefits of future generations.
Touching on the economics there, and we briefly talked about it earlier as well, but one of the things that the main parties seem very unwilling to face up to is the idea that we might be facing the end of the economic growth paradigm when we're facing an energy crunch and peak oil, which kind of underpins the growth in our economy currently, and so do resources which are not infinite. So you're prepared to put forward an alternative to the gross domestic product measure of growth that all government policy seems currently predicated on?
Gross domestic product is not a good way to focus on a better future. What we need to have is a series of measures which actually take us to where we want to go, not just lead us to consume a higher quantity of stuff with no real benefit to quality of life, as has been shown by analysis on the UK and the US over the last 20 or 30 years. We need to include the benefits of home working, of childcare, and old people's care, which aren't valued. The work of carers, for example, aren't properly valued in our economic system. And GDP, ironically, will show a company that causes masses of pollution and then allows another company to come along and clear that pollution up as actually growth in our economy, whereas it would be far better to simply not have that pollution in the first place. We need to have better ways of measuring whether we're being successful or not, and we need to make sure where we head is not simply growth of an economic indicator, but growth in our quality of life, in the sustainability of our communities, and that is only sustainable in the long term if we grow within environmental limits.
So we're facing a kind of triple crunch of an energy crisis, a climate crisis unless we act, and a credit crunch as well, which is taking a new bank every day at the current rate. We featured the Green New Deal on this programme before, and there's measures in there which include things like breaking up the banking sector and outlawing obscure financial instruments. And I know that the Green Party have endorsed this, I believe, at their last conference. Is that correct?
That is correct. And yeah. Caroline Lucas, the leader of the Green Party, was part of the team that produced the Green New Deal. So it's very much an initiative which we support.
Okay. Just thinking in terms of a strategy for the Green Party, I mean, some people might think that it's just a symbolic vote for the Green Party because they don't even have any MPs in Westminster currently, but perhaps the Green New Deal provides a new opportunity for a new alliance between Greens and disaffected Labour, trade unions and green industrialists. Is that being considered as a way forward? Particularly, we seem to be at a very peculiar historical juncture.
The Green New Deal highlights where we should be going. We need to deal with climate change, peak oil and provide new jobs at the same time. This provides an ideal opportunity for trade unions to move in a new direction and back industries that are sustainable. There is a real opportunity for the construction industry, as set out in the Green New Deal, to embrace the challenge of existing homes. We have close to 1 million empty homes in the UK, which could be utilised as new social housing, as was eloquently demonstrated in the recent BBC One programme. These opportunities are coming together. We are going into a time of economic difficulty. The current economic system is being shown to be unsustainable, even in economic terms. We can use this as an opportunity to build a new way forward. And the Green New Deal follows on from Roosevelt's plan after the Great Depression in America and suggests that this is a time for a turning point. But this turning point isn't just about jobs and about recreating a sustainable society. It's about doing it in a way which gives us a future, which is consistent with a green way forward.
So it looks likely that there's a good possibility that you might have your first MP in Westminster at the next elections. And you've also got two MEPs in Europe and a growing number of councillors. Can you point to ways that councillors and MEPs have made a difference?
Certainly. What we've shown is that one Green on a council can make far bigger difference than one more of one of the mainstream parties. And just individual Greens have been able to change the political landscape on individual councils and act influentially. We found that even when we had just one councillor in London, we were making inroads. And now we've grown from one Green on one council in London to Greens on six councils in the next elections in London. We are making progress. But it's not just about Greens in power, it's Greens in power influencing the wider political system. So when you vote Green, you're not just electing Greens into power, you're making every other party think. You're challenging the other parties to go greener as we stand and hold the challenge of where we need to actually be. We are taking the challenge of climate change, the challenge of equity, the challenge of a different way of doing progress to the political sphere. And its time has come.
There was a bit of a turning point in the Green Party at the last conference. You elected a leader for the first time in the person of Caroline Lucas. How is that going to change the way that the Greens operate? And do you think that enhances its possibilities of electoral success?
When Caroline Lucas gave her acceptance speech for being voted in as leader of the Green Party, she talked of how Greens need to show leadership at all levels and all Greens need to work together to provide a different politics and the possibility of a future in the UK. And it's through that leading together that the Greens can show that through a different politics with a different set of policies we can make progress. It is important that we gain the public recognition and the media coverage at this time, and that's why we've chosen to go down this route. And we think we have got a lot to say. There are interesting policies. The actions of councillors up and down the country, of Greens on the London Assembly and Green MEPs across Europe really are showing the other parties that progress towards a green future means doing things differently and doing things better. And that's why I hope that with Caroline Lucas taking us forward, supported ably by Adrian Ramsey, the leader of the opposition on Norwich Council, we can show that politics is changing and politics is going green.
How would you sum up the way in which your climate policies are different from the other parties?
I think the main difference is we don't have a climate change policy and then a separate education policy that accelerates climate change and a separate economics policy that accelerates climate change and a separate transport policy that flies in the face of climate change. What we have is a set of policies that work together and gives us a fair future, and a fair future that is actually a future. Business as usual can't continue. Our society will only address the climate challenge by making the significant changes needed to get to where we need to go. We can't just pick and mix our measures. We need to go for a lower speed limits, like 20-mile-an-hour speed limits, in urban areas, which have health benefits and save lives as well as save the climate. We need to invest in our existing homes and improve insulation instead of wasting money on road and airport expansion. It's about our farming methods. It's about whether we choose to have local shops or out-of-town supermarkets. What we need to do is recreate the possibility of living well and loving it. We've got a new story. It's that lightening our carbon load actually gives us a better quality of life, and we can improve well-being in that way. And we do not accept, as David Cameron seems to think, that you can just green ice the situation where it is and just have your cake and eat it. We've got a new way forward, but it's not just a policy on climate change. Green goes right the way through. It cuts across. It's social and environmental working together to give us a better future.
That was Jonathan Essex, a Green Party member from Surrey, who has recently stepped down as campaigns coordinator. You've been listening to the 300 to 350 show. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with a look at the Labour and Conservatives' climate change policies. In the meantime, you can hear this programme again, along with any other programme in our ever-expanding archive, at www.climateradio.co.uk. Thanks for listening.